Welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's radio show, AC23. The mission of the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge is to foster the creative capacity in the Capital Region through advocacy, resources, teaching, and training. Over the next 23 minutes, you'll hear from staff members, artists, and arts organizations throughout our region. If you'd like to hear this episode again, you can find it online at www.artsbr.org.
All right. I'd like to welcome our viewers and our listeners to the Arts Council Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus podcast. And this is a series where we try to just document some of the great artistry that's happened that's related to Baton Rouge in some way or another. And today is a real pleasure for me because I have an illustrious cast of characters. For me personally, when I was a teenager, they were kind of my university, so to speak, learning how to play music. And so I'm going to introduce these guys to get started. So to my left is Mr. Ben Williams. And Ben, would you basically describe yourself as a sound man first, or a sound engineer? And we'll get into like how we all fit into all of this later. But so we got Ben Williams. We have Mr. Gino Marino, who is kind of the central character in all this stuff. And Gino has, he owns Gino's restaurant, and I'll let him talk later as we get into it, how that evolved and how the music part came into play. Next to him is Larry Siebert, wonderful pianist, composer, arranger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And next to him is the illustrious legendary drummer from New Orleans, Johnny Vodakovich. And next to him is Dr. Bill Grimes, who is an amazing bassist, ran basically the jazz program at LSU, Louisiana State University, for many years. And that's where we begin. But the main focus of this podcast is just to kind of document and talk about a time, I would say, in the mid-80s. And guys, correct me on any of the facts here. But at Gino's restaurant, that's where our music scene really started, I think, really thanks to, of course, Gino, Larry Siebert, who was the pianist. And one person who's not here was a big part of that was Mr. Big Luther Kent. And I think he played a big part in that. So I'm going to get you guys started. The great thing about this podcast is I don't really have to say too much because these guys, they carry the history. And I'm going to kind of let them go for it. But Gino, could you kind of get us started on maybe just the history of the restaurant?
Well, the history of that restaurant, my mother started, opened the restaurant in 1966 on Perkins Road. Then we moved to the current location in 1975, and we're still there after 58 years. So on the music end, it was really a great story. And before going any further, Mike, I want to thank you, Ben, for all you did, Larry, for spearheading this thing, Johnny B, Bill. I mean, what can I say in words? But anyway, it really started out as we were going along in Gino's restaurant. I had this lounge that was really a holding tank. Back then, you're talking about in the 80s, it was basically a holding tank for Friday and Saturday where people would sit there and have a drink and wait for a table. Like the days when you used to say, Jones, your table's ready for 3. Fontenot, your table's ready for 5. So it was really bothering me because I wasn't really utilizing producing the space on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays. So I kept tossing some things around. What can I do with this space? I thought about happy hour. Nah, it's too much part of the restaurant. Gino's is a restaurant. I thought about maybe a sports thing. Nah, because that's going to be the same time, same atmosphere. And Luther Kent, you know, our good friend, all of us know him and love him. He came up with the idea. He says, you know, Gino, you're not a musician, but as many musician friends as you have, and as much as you love music, you know what you ought to do to this room? You ought to put a cool little baby grand piano in here and make this a cool, put up some jazz posters, and make this a little cool jazz, a little jazz room. man, I thought about it and thought about it. I said, that's it. That's it. So we went, bought a baby grand piano at O'Neill's. We got the jazz posters all around. Luther had one of those Jackson Square artists, and we got all these pictures up. No piano player. So we sat there looking at the piano for about a month, maybe. Just sat there. And I told Luther, I said, you got to find me a piano player. I said, I really don't want to approach this from a piano bar type of atmosphere, a sing-along type of atmosphere. I want to approach this from the musical end. He says, well, man, if it was in New Orleans, I could find you a dozen of them. I said, yeah, but we're in Baton Rouge. So what we do? So he calls me one night. He calls me, and you know Luther. He says, hey, Ed. He says, they got this guy named Larry Siebert. He's in the paper. He's playing at the White House Inn. Now, I don't know how long y'all familiar. White House Inn. I'll give you a little, just a brief history. White House Inn used to have a music venue, used to call the Independence Hall. And this past weekend, I just saw the Eagles and Steely Dan. I saw Steely Dan at the Independence Hall in 1973. Okay. So we go to the White House Inn, and Luther tells me, it's me and my brother, Lawrence, and Luther. We go see Larry. Larry's playing at the White House Inn. So we walk in there, and Larry's sitting there. And there was an upright piano. The venue was on his last leg. They were just trying to revive it. So we got in there, and Larry sees Luther, and he recognizes him, and as he usually does right in the middle of the song, hey, man, what's going on? And they started talking, so we sit down, and we start telling them this is my friends Gino and Lawrence Marino. I have Gino's restaurant, and this is what they're trying to do. We have a little, got a baby grand piano, this and that. How long are you going to be in town? Larry says, I'm in town. I'm looking for work. It's just one of those things that, Mike, you couldn't duplicate this if you tried. I don't care how much money you have, how much money you put into it. It's just one of those things that just happened. I don't know if it happened for a reason. It just happened. It just fell in my lap. And so Larry comes to work at the restaurant. 6 days a week he's playing. And I know, musicians are artists. I know it's just a matter of time, where at one point. So he comes and playing, and my whole goal is, because I really didn't know this thing was going to blossom to what it did. I had no idea. Nobody did. He was just playing, and Luther would sit in and sing, and word of mouth got around. Next thing you know, so-and-so is coming in. Larry's, bites him up with saxophone or guitar or violin, whatever. Great musicians, and this thing blossomed. This thing I know, my whole goal is if I didn't have to go to my pocket to pay Larry, if I could get a few people to come in before dinner and after dinner, it would be enhanced the restaurant. It would class up the restaurant. But this thing just went skyrocket. And Johnny, you can relate to this coming from an Italian grandmother. And when this thing blew up, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday was packed, just word of mouth. And my mama came out, and it was her Italian accent. Look what you make a club. You make a club.
I get the feeling that was.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I showed her what the register did, she said, oh, that's a good. So we got the green light. We got the okay from mama. Okay. So we go along.
Should have asked for a raise at that point.
So at that point, I just let, Larry just, I gave him full helm, whatever he wanted to do. The music was unbelievable. I can't tell you the people that played there. Now we look back now, looking at the pictures Larry showed me. Been recorded a couple of CDs and a lot of hours of recording over there. But the only thing I regret about this whole thing is I wish I would have known who was who and had pictures. I had pictures of who played there because it was probably the greatest musicians I ever heard. In Baton Rouge, for sure.
I mean, so, Larry, when they went to go see you, am I right in thinking that you had just moved back?
Right. I had tried living in New York, which lasted about a year, and it was great, I got to say. But, you know, my car was going to be repossessed, and so I moved back. And fortunately, I don't even know how I got the job at the White House Inn, but I remember the guy who hired me was a very hip guy and friends with Doc Severinsen. And, you know, and I appreciated him giving me a job to play for mostly no one. And then Gino came in and offered me the job there, and sure. And I got to say, one of the real key elements was to have had Luther there. And I grew up listening to Luther. You know, I used to go, I think it was the Belmont Inn, or there was a club off of Wooddale Boulevard that Luther used to play at. And I was in a few years younger, and I used to play at a club called the J Club around that time, too. And, you know, and then Gino, then I said, oh, and like Steve Hutter, who I believe played with Floyd Brown, yeah. Would come and sit in on sax, and then Wes Anderson came and sat in on sax. And one day I told Gino, hey, man, let me hire a bass player. And that even grew, it grew more. And then I said, you know, man, let me hire a drummer. And, you know, and of course, there's some hesitation each time I want to raise the ante. But then I called Johnny, and then, of course, Herman Jackson was in town. And because I had already lived in New Orleans for many years, I knew all the jazz, not all, but a lot of the jazz musicians, and I would just ask them to come play with me. And that included like Red Tyler and Earl Turbinton and Eric Traub and Steve Mazikowski, Hector Gagliardo, Chris Severin, Bill Huntington, and the list just kept growing, and it became a real thing. But when you were talking, it reminded me of something that I bet you don't even remember. But this is one of the funniest things that ever happened to me on playing there, because on the weekends, I would just play solo. And every week, this guy would come in wanting to sing. But it wasn't the kind of atmosphere that really warranted having a singer on the weekends, because it was just people eating. But there was one night, weekend night, where there wasn't that many people in the room, and this guy came in, and he just really wanted to sing. So I said, yeah, come up. And he sang an Elvis song. And to put it bluntly, he was pretty terrible. And so Gino sent me a note, and it said, get him off. And so he finished the song, and he said, can I do another one? So I handed him the note.
I love it.
Good deal, right?
All right, well, I got a story to add to that.
Keeping it real.
The thing I mostly remember about that place was the music. I hadn't been in Baton Rouge very long, maybe 3 or 4 years.
You had just come from?
From Rochester, New York, where I was in graduate school. And there were some heavy players up there. I mean, you know, it was deep, deep talent. And I got to play with Willis down here, but that was about it. So you hired Jay Ecker, remember?
Yes, yes.
Then Jay couldn't make it one night, so either you called me or he called me. And I went over there, not knowing what to expect. And this one was playing drums.
I remember.
And Tony DeGrotti was playing saxophone. I didn't know either one of them.
Half of Astro Project, basically.
Yeah. And we started playing, and I just started giggling inside. I was like, this is the best. But the level of musicianship that this guy, Larry, was always able to get. And the one story I can always tell, I'm not going to say who it was because I really don't remember, but somebody important came into the club, into the restaurant. I'm sorry. Sorry, Mama.
Club.
Came into Gino's. And he was with an attractive young woman who wanted to sing. You remember this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, well, Larry's thinking right now, which time?
Right, yeah, exactly.
Which guy with a pretty young woman? Was, yeah, let him sing. Let him sing. She can sing.
And
yeah,
there was probably a considerable age difference, too.
Yeah. Well, I don't really remember. So she wanted to sing. Is the tune You Don't Own Me? Is that the tune?
No, no.
You don't know me.
You don't know me.
You don't know me. Uh-huh. Okay.
You don't know the woman.
Yeah. So they figure out a key. Larry sets up this beautiful introduction. And she starts singing a perfect fourth away from where she should be.
Right.
She's like a half an octave away almost. And within two beats, we just slid over and played the rest of the tune. And I said, man, this guy's got a set of ears.
Right.
You know, because there are a lot of piano players who would have just not known what to do.
Either not known or not have made the adjustment.
I cared.
Yeah. Do you remember the night Eliani Elias was in town?
Yes,
yeah,
I certainly do.
I was in a band.
Yeah.
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 Because she was in town to do a concert in Lake Charles with their jazz band, but she couldn't get a flight into there, so she flew into Baton Rouge, and I was the handler for a day or so. She played, and...
Was it you, me, and her?
Yeah, I was on there. I was on that gig. And then another one, you remember the guitarist Gene Bertoncini?
Yeah.
He came in and played. It was just so much fun. And
well, let me tell you one thing I got to say about those two artists. And even to this day, and it's even louder today because the music has changed, but there's only in, what, 36 years, 38 years we've been doing the music, there's only been two times at Gino's in that room that you could hear a pin drop. And there was one, and Eliana Elias played, and when Gene Bertoncini played, you could hear a pin drop. I never seen Gino's like this. This is only two times. And when Eliana's played, Larry was just, he just listened. I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, the talent, I just can't, I mean, it's unmatched. It's unbelievable. But that's the only two times that I, in 36 years, that you could hear a pin drop in Gino's lounge.
This conversation is really sparking some memories that have, you know. But I remember I was living in New Orleans at the time, and I was on my way to play at your restaurant, and I was speeding. I'll confess. I was speeding, and a state trooper pulls me over. And I said, he says, you know you're speeding. I said, yeah, you know, I'm playing at Gino's tonight, and I'm running late. He says, you better get out of here.
Or Mama's going to be mad.
So,
the restaurant.
Yeah, there's it's amazing what food can do.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, and of course, that was a big part of it, too.
Big
part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, yeah, that was a deciding factor. You want to play Gino? Yeah. Oh, yeah. About the food, you know. Oh, who's playing? I already took the gig, yeah. By the way, who's playing?
Because there's the Arancini. Oh, and then who's playing?
and the Lawrence salad and the
Lawrence bread.
Yeah, the salad and the spaghetti, and it was, of course, then the Arancini.
And the Gino's bread, and
oh, and the White Swan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's like that drink, man.
And then the
Shaloni, man. I used to like that.
And then you get a cappuccino before you start the second set? I think they called it Sicilian Speed. Right?
Yeah, double espresso.
So,
there you go, Johnny.
So, but let's talk about you and somebody else I'm crazy about is my son, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Jonathan was in the club when he was 10 years old, sitting at the bar, drinking an orange juice, listening to this group. And you were there as a high school student.
Absolutely. You know, and that's honestly one of the big reasons why I wanted to do this today, not only to just document that time and, you know, how special it was, but, you know, unlike New Orleans, Baton Rouge didn't have nearly the resources for an up-and-coming musician. They just didn't. And not to mention just the vibe that you get in New Orleans. So I always felt like being able to go in that environment around just A-list players. And Gino, we kind of joke about this story, but I would go then in there as a 16, 17-year-old in high school. And, you know, I would sit right next to the piano, especially also in addition to the nights that the band was playing, just to go listen to Larry play solo piano. And a lot of times I'd bring my homework and be drinking a Coke and just watching Larry play. And that was my university, really. And then, of course, we might have private lessons here and there. But I'm not the only one. I mean, there were so many young musicians that were hanging out. We were throwing out some names a little early, like John Hebert, who now plays with Fred Hirsch up in New York, plays with a lot of people, just a monster bass player. But
wow.
He would be in there. And did he ever play the gig? I'm not sure.
I don't think so.
But Hebert, he didn't play a gig there?
I don't think so.
You sure? We didn't play together?
I don't remember that.
That guy's got altitude, man.
Jeez. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He's off the charts. Oh. You heard him play lately?
We stay in touch. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Man.
Yeah.
God.
Well, Brian Blade.
I remember hearing Brian from
his house and driving to...
Well, then you had the whole, you know, the students from LSU, Southern. And then with Southern, I'm thinking about people like, well, you mentioned Troy Davis.
Wes.
But like Wes.
Mm-hmm.
Dowell Davis.
Dowell.
On drums.
Ray Mouton.
Uh-huh.
Who played with us occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And
didn't Rick Margitza play a couple of those gigs?
Rick Margitza was there, yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking, Tony DeGrotti, Rick Margitza.
Yeah. Earl Turbinton.
Yeah, it doesn't get any better.
Or right. Stranger.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I'll never forget
Johnny Adams.
Oh, Johnny Adams. Wow.
Yeah, it was a great night.
Now, did Jermaine ever do that?
Yeah.
Jermaine and Joanne Crosby, formerly known as Lady BJ, she actually sang at Gino's after she became kind of famous doing Broadway.
Smokey Joe's Cafe
and Dreamgirls she was in.
Didn't we do a couple of nights with a singer named Little Queenie?
Oh, Queenie. Johnny and I worked with her for a long time.
She'd rewritten the lyrics to Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans? She'd rewritten to Do You Know What It Means to Live in New Orleans?
Oh, yeah.
It was dark.
We can credit Phil DeGree for those lyrics.
That's DeGree's input for sure.
Yeah.
He's dark.
And then there was Carrie Loring.
Oh, yeah, I remember Carrie.
Uh-huh.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in. And if you want to hear this episode again, you can find it on our website, artsbr.org, and click on AC23. We'll see you next time.